all three of us spent time in the exact same room at Methodist Hospital, the point where, you know, we put a Dale Coyne racing sticker on the door.
Were the nurses just like, boys, have you considered literally any other hobbies? Anything else? Just something that doesn't bring you here. Table tennis? Right. I don't know. Yeah. Competitive knitting? Like, it's like, where does it go?
A week after, I think it was the day I was walking in back into Gasoline Alley with my hands in bandages, you know, I'm walking along and I hear this, "Hey, Ross." And I turn around and it's Johnny Rutherford. And he's calling me over and he says, "Hey, welcome to the Crispy Critters Club." Like, you're one of us now. You've been burned.
Welcome to It's Not the Car. I'm Sam Smith. I'm a journalist and a club racer. And I have somehow been in the strange position of having the Indianapolis Motor Speedway all to myself at least three times, but not for the reasons you'd think. Ross, who are you? Go.
Ross Bentley, and I have never had the Indianapolis Motor Speedway all to myself, but I have driven around there once or twice, and now just kind of coach people, so that's it.
Okay. Jeff, who are you? Go.
I'm Jeff Brown, and I have never driven around the Indianapolis Motor Speedway, but I've been there trying to help other guys drive around it quickly as a race engineer, and still do that kind of stuff today.
Okay, so we switch formats on this show. We change things up every week because that's what's necessary, and we run the show, and we love you people, but you don't run the show. So we're pretty much going to do what makes us happy, and switching formats makes us happy. But today, the format we're using is something we call Ross Teaches Sam About a Thing. And that thing, in this case, is something Ross has a unique perspective on. It's how to be a rookie at the Indy 500. And we'll get to the meat of that in a minute, but we've kicked off a lot of episodes with me doing a little caffeinated monologue, or I sit there and ramble and stare out the window and scratch my navel and just kind of give you a basic info dump on what we're about to talk about. We're going to try that again with this episode. So, Jeff, Ross, that sound okay to you?
Go. Green.
Okay. So, take a big sip of coffee. Radio's all about sounds. So, hi, I'm Sam. We make this show because we like it, but also because it keeps our young producer, Mike, off the street and away from a life of crime. If you want to help both of those things happen, your luck. We have this thing called Patreon. For a few bucks a month, you get to help support the show, but you also get some neat perks like monthly bonus episodes. The money we raise through Patreon helps keep this show on the air. If you like what you're getting here and want to help us keep doing it, that'd be great. If not, that's fine too. We like you anyway. You're here. We're glad. Join at patreon.com/notthecar. Back to the show. It's 1993. We're in Indiana. It's the month of May. It's a Friday. We have a man. He's a 36-year-old racing driver. He's a fan of dad jokes. He's a kind and smart individual with a heart of gold. He has a knack for figuring out how to make himself faster. He's a man from a distant, romantic northern land, a place where the streets are paved with maple syrup, and every street corner as this, you know, a helpful policeman and on horseback, and you get your own little pet moose just for becoming a citizen. How are you now? It's the land of Stan Rogers and Barrett's Privateers, but none of that is important. What is important is where he is. He is at the Indianapolis Motor Speedway. It is his first time there. He has dreamed of racing in the Indy 500 since he was 7 years old. He has thought about it nearly every day, and he has made it finally, though not without trouble and push and heartache and just a whole lot of work, probably 1,000 hours of work, outside the car for every hour he actually spends in the car. He has sponsors. He has contracts. He has taken out a six-figure personal loan to help pay for this opportunity. He's made it through rookie orientation because, remember, this is Indy. There is a graduated and mandatory on-track certification program, this thing they've done at the Speedway. Every year the race is run. Every year they've held a 500 since 1936. And because he's who he is, but also because he's gotten where he is, he's learning every minute, because that's what you do at the Speedway. It's what you do at any track, really, at least if you're any good, or if you want to be any good, or if once you were good and you're not good anymore and you're sitting there thinking about how fast you were then. Now, in these rookie tests, because the Speedway is the Speedway, and because once upon a time, drivers used to show up at the thing having never raced on pavement, if you can believe it, the track wants to make sure you're not going to go out there on that first lap, shove it into the wall, kill yourself, kill a bunch of other people. And the process with which they do that, because it's indie, it was long ago codified and set into steps that, you know, may or may not match the needs of the modern era, but part of India's tradition, and tradition is the reason. And so new drivers still do this now. Then, as now, they go out there slowly. The month of May, they do a certain number of laps at a certain speed. Then they ratchet it up a little faster, then a little faster. And you have to do those laps before they'll let you run. These days, that's three phases of ratcheting, but there may have been as many as five in the past. Modern drivers have to complete 10 laps between 205 and 210 miles an hour, another 15 slightly faster, another 15 slightly faster than that. But the point is, our man from the Great White North, he did all that. He is part of a three-car team. Now, this team doesn't have a lot of money. Their engines in particular reflect this. On Thursday, our driver's teammate, he goes out there, he blows an engine, more than 220 miles an hour, he puts the car on the wall, he's sent to the hospital, doctors say he can't drive for a week. And our man, this gentleman, this dude extraordinaire from the most plaid-lined part of North America, he goes out there and he begins lapping in practice. He is in a 900-horse, 1,500-pound race car. He's doing more than 225 on the straights, 220 in the corners. And then, well, then, actually, you know what? I'm just going to read you something. I'm just going to leave this to the New York Times, what they wrote 2 days later on Sunday, May 16th, 1993. The rookie driver, Ross Bentley, 36, of Vancouver, British Columbia, was completing what appeared to be a routine lap when he suddenly stopped in the middle of the track on the main straightaway. He scrambled from the cockpit and fell to his knees on the track, beating at the invisible flames from the burning methanol fuel. All of which, you know, just makes me wonder, other than that, Mrs. Lincoln, how was the month of May? Now, Ross's Indy fire experience was not his whole experience, but it was part of it. We're not going to talk about the fire much. We'll talk about it a little. But the whole point here is that stuff happens at Indy that doesn't happen anywhere else. And sometimes the stuff happening at Indy is the same stuff happening everywhere else, at other speedways, at other racetracks. But because it's Indy, it's different. Ross, what does that mean? Where does that go?
Things happen fast at Indy. Duh.
But, all right, podcast over. Okay, cool. So that's an episode in 6 minutes. Great.
Yeah. So shortly after the rolling around in the front straight on fire, I'm eventually loaded into an ambulance and taken off to Methodist. And my wife is in a car following, and she gets a phone call from her parents in Victoria, British Columbia, saying, "We just heard on the radio that Ross is going to the hospital." And this is literally, I don't know, 10 minutes after this happened. News travels fast. So, I didn't know I made the New York Times. Wow.
Don't get a big head. It was an AP Wire piece. You're not that special. It was like 2 inches of copy. Also like, "Oh, Ross, also, you know, he's unattractive and slow. No one likes him. Not a nice guy."
Okay. The fire was part of my experience, but it wasn't the only part of my experience. I had some good moments. I had some bad moments. I had some moments that will stick with me for the rest of my life, and some that I wish would not stick with me for the rest of my life. Yeah.
Well, let's back up, right? So one of the things that I learned this early on, in the business when you start going there and talking to racers and talking to PR people, talking to teams, you know, the old line is that prep for next year's 500 starts 2 seconds after this year's 500 is over, right? And that's everything from sponsor deals to, you know, people thinking about where the hardware is going to come from, sometimes even car prep sometimes. That was 93. How long had you been in IndyCars at that point?
I thought you were going to ask me how long I had been preparing, and I was going to say almost 30 years. I had an odd IndyCar career. I'm doing in air quotes there. I first drove one race in 1990. I drove one race, two races in 91. Drove like half a dozen in 92, and in 93 finally got enough money to do 6 races, but we spread that over 18 races and did the season, which is silly. And I had to go to a bank at one point and asked for a little help to get through the month of May, and took, what was it, 11 years to pay off that loan.
Woof.
But I don't know if that was the smartest thing or the dumbest thing I've ever done in my life, but...
is there a word for both? SMUM? DART?
Yeah, something like that, yeah.
It'll be the title of my autobiography, whatever it is, but... Yeah. What? Okay, so you do that, and you know, how long before the 500, for the 93 run, did you know that you had a shot at being in the race?
Well, I had put a sponsorship deal together with AGFA Film, and we had sort of been growing that over the previous two seasons, and it finally got to the point where they're like, we're going to pay you X, and that's to cover a full season of IndyCar racing. And really, it was probably about, I'm trying to think, maybe an eighth of what Penske was spending for a season on a car. So it wasn't much, but we were going to be able to do that. So, you know, I knew at the beginning of the year, probably by, I think it was January when I signed a contract with them. So I knew in January that I was doing the full season. And as far as I was concerned, I was going to race in the Indy 500, finally, something I dreamt of, like I said, since being a little kid and finding out what the Indianapolis 500 was. So I knew for a while, and it was all part of the plan and all part of the prep. And, being a small team, and we were running, the Chevy Ilmor A engine in the full season at that time. The top teams were running the Chevy Ilmor C engine, which was the third generation. We were using the first generation, which was, and I don't know, Jeff, you know the exact numbers, but it was somewhere in the, you know, I'd heard 75 to 100 horsepower down on the C, the latest generation.
To 100? I'm sorry, it's 75 to 100?
Yeah. And so going to the Indianapolis 500, the plan was, because the Indy 500 in 93 was still part of USAC. It was the one race that was not part of CART. And therefore, it had the USAC rule. And there was that one strange rule that if you used a stock block engine, you could run more turbo boost. So rather than the, I think it was 40 inches of boost we could run with the Ilmor engine, I think we could run 45 inches with the Buick turbo engine. And that Buick engine for the previous few seasons had been really powerful and put cars on the pole and things. But come by the time 93 rolled around, the Cosworth Fords and the Ilmor Chevys, their horsepower was ranking up and getting closer to those Buick motors. So all the top teams ran those engines. So we were the only team, Dale Coyne Racing, myself, Robbie Buell, and Eric Batchelart were the only three drivers running the Buick engine. So I would say that the attention to detail in building those engines was lacking in 93.
So hold on a sec. So just for context, for people who don't know, so you know, the current IndyCar has been, it's been a spec car. There are two engine suppliers, and the series has basically been not frozen technically, but all but in the last 10 years. But That's a relatively long period of stability when it comes to Indy, you know, because for nearly the life of the race, things evolved every year, and there were engine suppliers that came and went, there were chassis suppliers that came and went, and everything was about going faster the next year, and somebody would figure some way to nudge through some loophole in the rules. The loophole would close, everything would change and change again. And you were smack in the middle of this period, right? When you say stock block, you mean it was a stock block, but that was one of a handful of different engines designs on the grid, right?
Yeah. At that time, all the teams would get a brand new chassis every single year. And we were running a 1-2-year-old chassis. I can't remember for sure. And Jeff, you could probably comment on there, give a little bit of insight on this, but between 92 and 93, they changed the rules that said there were these strakes, basically fins inside the diffuser of the under tray of the car that kept the airflow attached going underneath the car. In an attempt to reduce the aero downforce for 93, they were banned. So all the 93 cars were designed in a wind tunnel without them. And of course, engineers being engineers, they figured out a way to get just as much downforce without them. But you take a 92 chassis, which I was in, I think it was a 92 or a 91, and you take those out because the rules say they have to be removed. Now the airflow didn't quite work so well. And, you know, we went through this porpoising thing in Formula One, you know, in the, a couple of years ago. And my IndyCar would porpoise. It would, you know, drive down the straightaway. It would suck itself down to the track and close off the air flow underneath it, or do some weird air thing underneath the thing. And all of a sudden it would kind of pop up, and then it would suck itself back down again, and it would pop up, and then it would do that. So you'd turn into turn one at Indy, foot flat to the floor, the thing would be sucked down the track, and in the middle of the corner it would just go, sorry, we just took, I don't know, Jeff,
hundreds of pounds
of downforce out of the car. And I had a moment when that happened in turn one, and I did three 360 degree pirouettes and ended at the exit of turn two. I hit the wall about as bad as, you know, you're walking down the hallway in your house and you bang an elbow against the wall. That's about how hard I hit the wall.
Nice driving.
Because he's a race driver, he'll take credit for it. So in basically January, and you know that the car's only going to be so competitive, and you know that there's, you know, Ross Bentley's probably not going to stand top step in the podium when he shows up, but you know that it's a shot at being in the show. What do you start doing from January on? How do you start prepping for the thing? How do you get your mind right? I asked this because you're Ross. I know you didn't just go, oh, cool, and then, you know, mark it on the calendar and walk away. I know you probably had some 4,000 point plan on how you were going to mentally ready yourself for this, because that's how you work.
I would say the biggest thing is I did a lot of mental imagery, visualization of driving the Indy 500. I've watched, you know, it's not like I could just hop on YouTube back in 1993.
Yeah.
But you could find, you know, there'd be somebody that had a CD, or I can't remember. Did we have CDs then? I can't remember. But, you know,
real
I could get
real.
A.
It was reel to reel. That's what it was.
Yeah. 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 It was a little man turning a crank on something or other. Yeah.
Right. A zoetrope, a hamster on a wheel and a flickering light bulb.
Exactly. Yeah.
No iRacing? You didn't jump on iRacing and just do?
That was the next year. Yeah.
Oh, okay.
But, you know, I did find a couple of videos, but I would just go back and I'm going to say this was actually an advantage, was not having those things.
Really?
Because I had started, I'm going to say, I don't know, sometime in the 60s. When did Wide World of Sports start televising the Indy 500? And I watched every single moment of that I could ever get on TV. So in 1993, I started replaying all of those races, all of those images, everything that I could ever come across. I'd start, you know, I would go through magazines and I'd look at photos of cars going through turn four, and I'd put myself in that car. I would imagine myself in that car. And I did that for months leading up to that. And probably 8 years before that, my brother and I were driving across. We'd been at Mid-Ohio racing a former Atlantic car. We're driving back across the country, and we're like, we're driving through Indiana going, there's the speedway. And I'd always told myself, I'm not going there until I'm a driver. But it was just a little too tempting. So we pulled into the parking lot, walked up to the museum and poked around. And if someone listening to this has never been to the speedway, the first time you go there, you can't imagine. You watching it on TV, you can't picture how big the place really is, right? You go there and it's just like everything looks 10 times bigger than it does on TV. But they had these little short buses that you could pay, I don't know, 75 cents, and they would take you for a ride or a drive around the track. So my brother and I got in this little bus, and this man that had to be at least 108 years old drives out on the track.
He was probably 120.
Yeah, yeah. Wearing a yellow shirt and a whistle in his mouth. and he drove us around the track. So even that, you know, those images that I had from riding around in that bus, I just played them over and over and over and over again in my head. And, you know, Sam, you said, you know, did I expect to go there and see myself drinking milk? I did mentally prepare for that. I did visualize that. Now, was it realistic that was going to happen? Probably not, given the team, the equipment, the budget, everything we had. But, you know, we convinced ourselves that being clever and going with this Buick turbo engine that had a some kind of an advantage, we could make up for some things that we didn't have. So, you know, we went into that event and thinking that we can make up for that. And unfortunately, between Eric Batchelart, Robbie Buell, and myself, in, I don't know, 2 weeks, we went through 13 engines.
Those are your two teammates at yeah. Coyne, right?
Yeah. Who, and all three of us spent time, actually, kind of ironically, but all three of us spent time in the exact same room at Methodist Hospital from the engines blowing
same
and causing
room?
These problems. To the point where, you know, we put a Dale Coyne Racing sticker on the door.
Where the nurses just like, boys, have you considered literally any other hobbies? Anything else? Just something that doesn't bring you here. Table tennis? Right. I don't know. Yeah. Competitive knitting? Like, it's like, where does it go?
Yeah. So that was, that was it. And, you know, did go back for qualifying weekend the following weekend and, you went out on Saturday morning and, let's see, I think I did like four laps and then came in and went back out again. This was on practice on the second weekend. This is when they had 2 weekends of qualifying. It was the second, weekend, Saturday morning. There was some open practice, went out, and the second time I went back on track, I could hear the engine rattling, like it was going to blow again.
Yeah, rattling.
Like rattling, like, you know, like a rod bearing kind of a rattle. Like
you could hear it in the car over the exhaust and over wind noise and everything else.
Yeah.
I mean,
yeah,
like I've heard rod bearings go on the street, but like, and yeah, you could hear it.
Yeah. And I could hear it exiting pit lane.
Really?
So, you know, it's not something that I'm either very proud of or not so proud of and don't, but I drove out in the back straight, left it in first gear and just held my foot to the floor up against the rev limiter, just bop, 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 and boom, and it blew. And I kind of did it because, to be honest, I was scared because I knew it was going to pop and it was going to put me back. I was going back to Methodist.
But that's the thing, right? Robbie's crash, you know, what was it, the Thursday before your fire, the motor popped and that's what put him in the wall. Like it's Speedway stuff. You could actually die because the thing goes bang. I don't know if there's anything wrong in that, but
well, and then a week later, the doctor said, you're cleared. You can go again. He's out for practice. Another motor pops, puts him back in the wall again, the second time. And the doctor said, you're now done for the month. And by the way, that was the Friday. That was the Friday before the second weekend. I had gone back to the track with my hands, face, neck, all bandaged up, looking like a mummy. But the doctor said, if you can put gloves on and a helmet on, you can go and drive. So that was the Friday. And I'm going back to the track. And I go back to the track and I get a call on the way saying, Robbie's crashed again. He's off at Methodist. But as I pulled into the speedway, I can see the Dale Coyne Racing pit cart at the medical center. And I'm thinking, oh, Robbie must still be in there. So I'm going to stop and run in and see how he's doing. But I go in there and Eric Batchelart's in there because he'd had a motor pop, spit him into the wall. He got in feet first and it cracked his ankles, fractured something, bone in his ankle. So, you know, Robbie's at Methodist. Eric's just about to be loaded up in another ambulance to be taken to Methodist. And I'm going in and trying to get a helmet on over the bandages on my face and neck and everything. And putting these massive gloves on over top of my burnt hands.
Wow.
So that was kind of the state of mind I was in at that moment in time. And yeah, so that afternoon, Friday afternoon, a motor popped. And then fortunately it did it on the back straight. So I coasted in the pits. And then it was Saturday morning when that happened again, when it was like, no, it's not going to spit me into the wall here. And so the amazing thing is that afternoon, Dale Coyne and the crew decide, okay, we're going to convert the car back from a Buick engine car back to a Chevy Ilmor car, which meant floor and engine mounts and all sorts of stuff. Jeff,
May. They did this in May.
Saturday. They started Saturday afternoon. Sunday morning, the car was ready for me to drive.
Man.
Wow.
And guess what? Sunday morning, it was raining.
Oh.
And it rained all the way until like a couple hours before the end of qualifying. Anyways.
Okay. So let's back up here. So one of the you mentioned this earlier, you know, there's something about going to that place. And, you know, if you've been to big oval tracks, so many of them just feel like it's not like going into Dodger Stadium or Wrigley Field. It's not like the big house at the University of Michigan. You just walk into the thing and there's a big oval around you and there's some stands and they're kind of generic and there's nothing there. But Indy, you know, the main entrance is on, I think it's 16th Street in Speedway. Mm-hmm. And you drive down there's this kind of 4-lane ramp beneath that goes down below ground level beneath the set of grandstands between turn 1 and 2 in the short chute. And when you pop up out of it, the first thing, you know, your car kind of goes up the hill and, you know, the nose level's off. And the first thing you see is the museum, which looks like this. It's this weird kind of, it's mid-century, but has some, like, I don't know, Roman elements to it. This weird kind of little lump of architecture sitting right in front of you that looks almost like a temple. And there's this row of flags in front of it, a little ramp. And it's been there forever. It's been there for, you know, most of the existence of the Speedway. I think they built it in the 60s. And you're immediately presented with that. And if you're going off to the paddock and the pits, you make a left before going in the parking lot for that. And the first thing, you mentioned the medical center. I don't know where it was then. I'm assuming it was fairly close. But the first thing you see now is that. So you drive by the medical center. And as if the whole track is just trying to remind you, like, oh, hey, a lot of that goes on. And then, you know, you drive a little quarter mile down and then there's, you know, the row of garages and the rest of the paddock. And it is massive. There is this sense of scale that you get. And it could be, I mean, I've been in speedways that are physically larger and more imposing. I've been in racetracks that are larger and more imposing, just road courses. But there's this sense of something about it. So the first time you rolled in, when in May did you get there? What part of the month?
I'm going to say, actually, we showed up in maybe the last week of April.
Okay.
Because rookie orientation started, I can't remember the exact dates, but somewhere around the very end of April, going into the first week of May. And you know, at that time, basically, you know, if you didn't live in Indy, you moved to Indy for the month of May.
Yeah.
So my wife and I, Robin, we showed up somewhere towards the end. The team had helped us find an apartment that we would rent for the month of May. And so you'd show up and, you know, you kind of go to the grocery store and stock up your furnished apartment for the month of May. So we did that. And then, you know, then the rookie orientation starts and one of the things that I hope will never go away is, you know, you had this rookie orientation, you have this meeting and they kind of, you know, there were guys there who, I mean, went through rookie orientation with John Morton, you know, John Morton, who won everything in road racing and, you know, and he was going through rookie orientation the same time as me. And there were guys who I don't think they'd ever been to the Speedway ever before and probably didn't know how to spell Indy. You know, some Europeans and South Americans that were, you know, that were Indy didn't know what Indy was, right? They didn't have that history. But you sit down and you have some 84-year-old officials start talking to you about things and then Rick Mears walks in the room and, you know, it's Rick Mears. And he starts talking about how the approach to driving here and everything. And then they kind of go, okay, you hop in that pace car with so-and-so, you hop in that pace car with so-and-so, and Ross Bentley, you hop into that pace car with Rick Mears. I'm going, oh,
to
cool.
back up, wow. just for anybody, again, for anybody who doesn't know, one of the winningest driveways, one of the winningest drivers in Speedway in IndyCar history, famously ran the 500, won it multiple times, you know, without crashing, like coolest cat cucumber there ever was, Californian. Like, I don't know if the man has a face that basically just says, I'm not going to get worked up first. You are. And you get, you hop in the pace car with him and what? Like Rick drives you around in a van or a Camaro or whatever it was.
It was a Camaro.
80 miles an hour?
Yeah, yeah. And yes, I mean, Rick won the Indy 500 four times. one of the classiest, nicest people in all of racing.
Yeah.
I'm going to say the interesting thing about Rick Mears is he's won the Indy 500 four times, but he's not as well known as AJ Foyt or Elio Castroneves or whatever. He's just kind of a humble, down-to-earth kind of guy, you know? Anyways, yeah, so we're driving around in this pace car, and he's just pointing out certain things to me, like, you know, we're coming through, and he's like, you know, you want to kind of sight this, you want the car placed, you know, 2.2 inches from the wall here, and you want to do this here, and you want to be thinking about this, and we're driving down the back straight, and he says, you see the windsock on the top of the grandstand in turn three? And I'm kind of like, oh, there it is. That looks like some, you know, like a child's, you know, a baby, a one-year-old's sock stuck on the top of a grandstand a mile and a half away. And he's like, yeah, every time you come down the back straight, you look to that. And if it's blowing in that direction, the car is going to push understeer going into turn three. If it's blowing in that direction, the car is going to be oversteer going into turn three. And then you come around the front straight and you look at the windsock on the top of the scoring tower. And that's going to dictate how the car is going to handle going into turn one. So you do that every lap. And I'm thinking, really?
One of the things two highlights of my career, two of the major highlights of my career were the two times I got to talk to Rick because I'm a giant dork. But I interviewed him once. We got to talking about how people who come to the Speedway look at it and how they think differently. And he said, you know, on average, most people kind of treat it with not the reverence it deserves, but, you know, okay, it's a big place, it could kill you. He said, but there's a good chunk of people who show up that just kind of look around and like, yeah, it's an oval track. Okay, sure, fine. And then they go out or they have a moment or something happens or they, you know, they bounce it off the fence and then they come back and then they start asking all the questions that they probably should have asked to begin with. But how did that place, how did it hit you? You'd driven speedways before, right? Does it feel different? I mean, it is different, but it's not different, right?
Yeah. And let me tell a quick funny story about that. How some people show up and yeah, they're in awe of the place and some are just another track. What's the big deal? My teammate, Eric Bachelart, during one of the practice sessions in the first week, he's out on track and there's a car in front of him who keeps kind of blocking him. Like, and Eric's trying to get by and is like, you know, Eric's figuring out how to get around this place, but this guy is just making life really difficult for him. And they both come down into pit lane. They stop. Eric is so mad that he gets out of the car, walks back down pit lane to this other car. The other driver sitting in the cockpit, and Eric kind of reaches in and starts to grab him by the driving suit around the neck. And like, you idiot, you blah, blah, blah. Probably some words that I won't repeat here. Otherwise Mike is just going to go beep, 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 beep.
Wait. We have to, let's just be honest. Those words don't exist in Canadian. They just don't, they're not in the language.
Well, Eric is Belgian. So Eric might've been using those.
Okay.
Yes. Sure. Okay.
Which is basically French. So there you go.
Yeah. So Eric is like, and everyone's kind of laughing and like, come on. Like anyways, Eric goes back and a while later, this driver gets out of the car and at some point he walks up to Eric with a hero card that he has signed and says, here you go, Eric. And it's Gordon Johncock, 2-time Indy 500 winner.
Wait, why?
So, that's great.
I don't know what to say to that. That's amazing.
So there is an advantage sometimes in being that naive.
Yeah.
But so you go to Indy and I think, you know, this is kind of what you're talking about with Eric, with what Rick was talking about is you got to go there with a a respect for the place, but not a, oh my God, where, look what I'm at. You know, like, you got to find that right balance. You have to respect it, but not be in total awe of the place to the point where you can't handle it. And I think that is one of the challenges of the place. When you go there, you know, you're smacked in the forehead with the history, the size of the place, the fact that you're walking around and, you know, you bump into AJ Foyt or Mario Andretti or Gordon Johncock or Johnny Rutherford, or, I mean, there are these guys who are, you know, icons of the sport and the Indy 500. And what you find out is they're just guys, you know, they're just drivers. Yeah, and, you know, a week after, I think it was the day I was walking in back into Gasoline Alley with my hands in bandages, you know, I'm walking along and I hear this, "Hey, Ross," and I turn around and it's Johnny Rutherford. And he's calling me over and he says, "Hey, welcome to the Crispy Critters Club." Like, you're one of us now, you've been burned. And to this day, I mean, I'll go to an IndyCar race and Johnny is still around doing stuff and he'll go, "Hey, Ross, Crispy Critter," you know, like, so I think in a way that I became one of them, or they more accepted by being in a fire there.
Ross Bentley and the Crispy Critters is either like the world's worst animatronic band at Disney or the world's best Sunday morning cartoon show, but I don't know which one it is.
I've got a question for Ross.
Yeah. Please, Jeff, I'm so sorry.
You talked about ROP, Rookie Orientation Program, and I've had the good fortune of engineering some drivers who have had to go through that thing, and some super experienced drivers like Formula One driver Michele Alboreto. I mean, he had done 200 Formula One races, still had to go through the rookie orientation program. And drivers who had come literally out of Silver Crown pavement sprint cars and never drove an Indy car except maybe a couple times leading up to this. And every one of those guys, no matter his experience, told me the hardest part to learn was to do the slow laps, phase one. Sam talked about phase one, to do the slow laps of ROP, because you have to do it within that 10 mile an hour, whatever it is, depending on the speeds that year. But 200, you know, a good lap is 225, and you got to do it at between 200 and 210, which is really slow in relatively. And they said that was the hardest thing they had to do, was to be able to keep it in that range. Did you find the same thing? And if so, how did you do it?
Absolutely. I think, I'm trying to remember exactly, but there were four phases, all 10 mile an hour windows. I think phase one was 190 to 200. Then it was 200 to 210. Maybe it was 180 to 190. Anyways, that first one was by far the hardest. And like the last one was, I don't know, 210 to 220. That was easy, because it was just, you know, the team. And I was actually trying to think about this not long ago. I don't think we actually had an engineer on our team.
Wait, really?
We had Dale, and we had the crew chiefs on each car who had been around their bench. But, you know, I don't remember actually us having an engineer. But, you know, I think what we did for the 210 to 220 was, you know, they put wing in the car that I could just go flat to the floor all the way around the place and run at 215 easy. To go 200 to 210, you know, I had to do like a little breathe into each corner. The 190 to 200 range was, and by the way, the 210 to 220, I did that in, you have to do 10 laps. I did that in 10 laps. The 200 to 210, I did that in 10 laps. The 190 to 200, I think it took me like 14 or 15 laps to get my 10 in, because I had to figure out how much to breathe the throttle. Because it was harder to drive slow. But I will say it was really good experience driving, you know, for me being new and having just gone through a lot of like I said, visualizing what I could see. I didn't have, you know, I couldn't sit down with hours and hours of YouTube videos of watching stuff. I was creating my own. And those laps, those early laps at 195, let's say, allowed me to kind of really pay attention to getting my references, getting my sight lines, all those kinds of things. And so that it was actually helpful, but it was hard to do.
Yeah. What made it difficult besides the obvious thing of race car won't go fast?
Well, it was because if you went 201, that lap didn't count.
That lap didn't count.
So you had to do 10 laps in that range. And yeah, I don't know if they would like, you know, will fuel you for 15 laps. So you got to get 10 in out of 15 laps in. They didn't do it as a, you know, you had to do 10 in a row. But it's not like you could go out there and turn 100 laps and say, well, 100 of them were in there. there was some number you had to do it in. And yeah, it was just, you had to figure out how to go slow. And, you know, the combination of that and then, and Jeff, I'd actually like you to talk about this of when you've run other people, but there is that barrier, and every year it changes based on the aero of the car, but there's a barrier where you're driving around and you're turning lap times of, I don't know, that year was, you know, like 212, 214, and the car felt like it was going to kill you any moment. And then you either just held your foot down and went flatter through the corners, full throttle through the corners, or they did something to the car that made you allowed you to go, and you'd get to like 218, 219, 220. All of a sudden it was like, oh, this is easy.
Yep. As I got more experience running the rookies, and we had more information than you had in 93. This was 96, 97, 98 kind of area.
You went from an abacus to a
larger
pen and paper.
right, exactly. But what I tried to do and seemed to work for my guys was, as you said, Ross, if you're driving 200, you have a certain amount of downforce and you... and that'll push the car down to a certain level. If you're driving 220, it's going to push it down more. The closer you can get the car to the ground, the more downforce it makes. So what we tried to do was adjust the static ride height. Excuse me. Adjust the static ride height so that it would be the same as if you were running a 225 mile an hour lap. If you were running a 200 lap, if you were in that 200 to 210 phase that you had to do, we would just lower the car. And we had the information to know that 20 miles an hour slower, the car would run 3 millimeters higher. So we would lower the car 3 millimeters. If you went faster than that, it was going to hit the ground, but we knew you weren't going to go faster than that. So we tried to get it to handle similarly through all of those phases so the driver didn't have to adjust to it. And then we put, I mean, it seems simple. McKaylee is the guy who came up with this. He said, just put on the dashboard, you know, most people know there's lots of information on the dashboard. We just put a giant speedometer on the dash. And he would just say, I'm just going to, if it's 200 to 210, I'm just going to put the car at 205. And I'm just going to drive around and try to keep that speedometer reading 205. All the way around, in the corners, on the straightaways, every place. And because the car handled pretty similarly, he was able to do that. But still, he said, that was hard. He said, that was not race car driving. That was like, why are we doing this? And how does this help me be a better driver so I'm safe and understand what I'm supposed to do when there's 32 other cars out here?
Well, that's what's remarkable, right? And I think it helps to remember that, you know, again, the rookie, what did I say? It was like 36 when they started the rookie tests. And, you know, you think back up until the aero era, the cars were moving constantly. There's a piece of footage that circulating around the internet pops up every couple of years. Somebody in the mid 60s hung a film camera on Mario Andretti's car. during testing or practice or something. And it's, you know, you can picture this big 60s movie camera, reels on top of it. And it's looking down at him and the front suspension, and you can see his hands on the wheel, and you can see down the track. And it's, you know, it's a typical rear engine car, mid engine car of the era, so kind of cigar bodied and wheels hung out fairly wide from the body. And the car is constantly moving and sliding. And you look at it and you think, okay, well, you know, there was a period where whatever the special technique of going around a speedway was then, it changed significantly every decade. But there was a period where that orientation program was deeply necessary because there were people who had, you know, like you said, Jeff, came up out of sprint cars who had slid a car at 70 miles an hour, 80 miles an hour on dirt, but hadn't done that at $1.50 or $1.60, and certainly hadn't done it in traffic, and certainly hadn't done it in crosswinds and traffic on pavement. And all of those things were necessary. But there is a very significant argument to be made that the rookie orientation program is kind of a relic, one of the many relics of the way things used to happen at Indy that's hung around. You said Alboreto went through it. How, when he actually started doing full speed laps of the track, how did his perspective on it change?
I think it was more like what he was used to. Okay. Right? He was a race car driver trying to go fast.
Yeah.
And then all of those rookies suddenly went from, and I'd like Ross to talk about this, because they went from, oh, I'm a rookie and I got to watch my P's and Q's and I don't want to block a guy and, you know, and probably a little bit like Ross explained with Eric Batchelart, is like, no, he was a race car driver and some jerk was blocking him and he didn't care who it was. And they all turned into instantly the minute they got that check off of your past rookie orientation, they're race car drivers. And all they want to do is go fast. And so what I was going to ask Ross, okay, now, so you've passed that, Ross, and you get through that. And now you're in race car driver mode, super competitive. You want to go fast. And I don't know the details, but I hope there was some period in there where you weren't just blowing up engines all the time and you actually did get to try to figure out how to make the car go around quickly. The thing that I've always come up with rookies is how you're on a road course and you want to push the car to the limit. You can push it over the limit a little bit, get it sideways, and the thing gets sideways and you like catch it and you're like, ooh, lift, and okay, it didn't spin out. At the speedway, that's a very, very, very fine line. You can't just wheel it into turn one and get the thing, you know, 30 degrees sideways in turn one and just go, oh, okay, I see where the limit is now. You know, you end up crashed. And so how is it for a guy who's never been around the speedway and now you're in full race mode, I'm going hard here, to figure out how much, it's always how much front wing can I put in? As the engineer, I want to put in front wing, or even better, take out rear wing so I reduce the drag. And it's always me going, let's take out rear wing. And the driver's like, ooh, I think it's really loose. And so how do you feel that balance when you can't, when you really can't step over it? We've all seen some really cool pictures of guys catching it at Indy. And why are those cool? Because that almost never happens. You almost never catch it. So how do you learn that, Ross?
I think anybody who's done any kind of driving on a road course thinks that driving an oval is easy. You just turn left. And I will say it is the most difficult thing that I've ever done in my life. And it's because of, you know, and it was something that Rick Mears talked to me about, is the precision. And I can't remember if it was him that actually said this, but you know, on a road course, if you get within 4 inches of your line, lap to lap to lap to lap, that's really consistent precision. At Indy, it's more like half an inch every lap. And you've just have to, because, and if you're 1 inch off of your line, you have to adapt to that. And yeah, I mean, you know, catching a slide, at Indy, you know, yeah, we see it every now and then, but most of the times it ends up with a hard right turn into Methodist Hospital. And so you kind of just keep creeping up on it. And going back to Michele having the speedo on the dash, I mean, I had that in 93, and you would go through a corner, and I can remember, like, you know, out of the corner of my eye, perfectly looking down, and you would see on the dash, you'd see 222 as you turned into, let's say, turn four. And as you turn the steering wheel, it would go 221, 220, 219, 218. And then you're like, okay, I got to straighten the wheel. I want to straighten the wheel. And as soon as you start to just like even think about straightening the wheel, you see 219, you see 220, you see 221, you see 222. And it made me a better road racer because I realized just how important that steering angle is to the freedom of the car, letting the car release off the corner, let it run free kind of thing. And so, I think if you go to a place like Indy and you try to drive the car off the rear of the car, where you're trying to sense, when's the rear going to come around? When's the rear going to come around? There's the rear. I'm going to work with that. Yeah. Again, you're probably going to end up in the hospital. So yep. You feel it off the front end. You know, you turn in, you get that little, you get some understeer, and eventually I would say to you, Jeff, you know, yes, you can take some rear wing out or you can add some front wing, but I need more front.
Make car
and because
turn
right
more.
Now I'm turning the wheel more and I see that speedo thing dropping down or I feel it. Like I feel it just scrubbing the front. And then it's like, you get to that point where it's like, okay, right now I'm not scrubbing the front. And, you know, if I turn the wheel a little bit more, the car turns a little bit. But if I open it up, the car runs free. But it doesn't also, like, I don't turn a little bit and I don't feel like, oh, my God, now the rear is going to come around. And I'm going to say I had some wonderful, memorable moments of that during practice at the Speedway. And the weird, wacky thing, I mean, I can't remember, like pole in 93 was 225-ish, I think. I think 33rd was, you know, slowest time was somewhere in the 215 range. And I ran laps in practice that were like 221. And I'm going, you know, we're solid
here.
We're there. And then, you know, that afternoon or the next morning, the car has not been touched. And Jeff, you had this experience.
Oh, yeah.
You know, the engineer was not even in the Speedway. You know, the mechanics had gone home. And you come back and you get in the car and you go out there and you're running 214. And you're like,
what happened?
I ran a session and I was running 214. I came into the pits and the guys are looking at the right side tires and going, whitewalled it. I kind of turn two trying to use all the track, like getting the steering wheel out. And the right side tires had just like skimmed the wall coming out of the corner. And you got white walls on the tires. And so that is the weirdest experience. Weird is maybe not the right word there, but frustrating. Because one moment you're easily doing 220 or whatever. And then it seems like moments later you're struggling to do 214. And it really, you know, like, I'm going to say that is one of the differences between a road course and something like a speedway is on a road course, the difference in weather and track conditions. Yeah, it makes a difference. But as a driver, sometimes I can trick the car to do things. On an oval, maybe Rick Mears could, but I think Rick Mears would have been the first to say, don't try tricking the car on the speedway.
So there's a couple of things I want to come back to touch back on here. So one, you know, you see that it's interesting too, because you see that in drivers that will change teams year to year, right? And clearly don't have the same engineering or the same resources that they did before. And, you know, you can look at them and go, wow, you know, so-and-so absolutely stinks this year, or wow, so-and-so is great this year. And yet last year they weren't. And so much of it is in setup. But that leads me back to, you know, you guys mentioned the notion of a car on a speedway, not just Indy, but any speedway, being really, really difficult to catch when it breaks, when it's loose, getting it back under you. And there are times that it happens, but I know why that's true, right? It's a combination of the way physics and response time and spring rate and aero and all of that stuff works. But can you unpack that a little? Because there aren't, you know, it's people can sit there, a lot of people sit there and watch drifting and think, oh, hey, it's very, very easy to put a car sideways. Why can't somebody keep a sideways car sideways on Indy? But explain what's going on there, if you don't mind, both from a driver standpoint and an engineering standpoint, right? What does it feel like and what's going on with the car that makes it so difficult to get back under you at 220, especially one of those cars, right?
Well, I mean, that's the thing, right, Ross? You were describing, Ross, how you would talk to the engineer about they can put more wing in front or take some rear out or whatever if you were comfortable. I've always said, and this was my experience at Indy, drivers would come in. I've never had a driver, maybe once, but come in and say, oh, the car is too loose. Because they report that to you from when you visit them in the hospital. It was too loose. What the report you get is, man, it's just too free. You know, that means like it's not loose because you crash if it's loose. If it's oversteering, you know, you never hear oversteer or loose. You hear a little bit too free. Let's tighten it up a little bit, which means it's just, you know, I don't have enough understeer. And we always talked like you did, Ross, you said about the steering wheel. I always talked with my drivers about at Indy, you don't hit the brakes, but you have a brake in your hand. And drivers would actually use that. You know, if they know they had a good, comfortable understeer, they would actually turn in. And if it was just carried a little bit too much speed, they'd just turn a little bit more. And the car didn't turn. It would just slow down 2 miles an hour. And then like, okay, perfect. They knew that if they didn't have to do that, they would go 2 miles an hour quicker, but they felt they had to for some reason. And like you said, Sam, what happens? Why is it that way? I think it has a combination to do with the aerodynamics. You know, where as the cars got better and better, they are more consistent at some kind of yaw angle. And we're talking small yaw angles at Indy. You know, we're not talking 10 degrees, we're talking 3 degrees, but still the air is going across the car at a 3 degree angle. And now we're measuring the aerodynamics with the car yawed in wind tunnels and CFD. And that's important because if we can make it consistent, the aerodynamics are always the same for the driver, whether he's going straight when he turns into the corner or yawed 2, 3, 4, 5 degrees, the driver can deal with it much easier. But if it's not, then suddenly the driver gets some weird feeling that he's not used to. And it only takes another extra degree of yaw to make the thing just feel completely different. And the driver's spooked and he's out of the gap.
And Jeff, the other term that we use is the car is too neutral.
Yeah.
I'd like it to be less neutral, meaning
right.
Give me just that hint of push. Because yes, I can sense that. And, you know, I don't know what the actual time is, but let's say on a road course, you go into a corner and the car starts to oversteer and it's a corner that you're taking at, I don't know, 60, 80 miles an hour. The rear of the car starts to come around. You have, and let's just throw a number at it. Let's say you have a second to catch it. It's probably less than that. I'm sure it is less than that, but let's pretend it's a second. I've driven on road courses where you're going through a corner at 130 miles an hour. You might now have half a second to catch it. At 220 miles an hour, you have in that same relative thing, you have a tenth of a second to catch it.
Mm-hmm.
Now, we all know that 1 second is really, that's too long. So you got to compress all that. So maybe now you've got 0.02 of a second to catch it. And that's why trying to catch a slide at Indy rarely works. And that's why, you know, one of the things you're told when you first go there is if the rear starts to step out, don't countersteer, don't turn in opposite lock, because what's going to happen is the rears will hook up. And at that point, you've got those steering wheel pointed towards that concrete wall over there, and you're going to go in really hard and it's going to hurt. So let it go. And it's something that oval racers have learned, even on short ovals, you learn that if the rear is coming around, just let it go. And the best actually sometimes every now and then will actually turn left even more, make the thing spin around. And, you know, we see that sometimes in sprint car drivers, where they can kind of do one of these 360s, pop a wheelie and carry on going again, you know? And I'm going to say that was something that I did to prepare. And especially after my little time with Rick Mears was, you know, he talked to me about that. He's like, don't try to catch it. Just keep the steering wheel where it is, or even turn left a little bit. And Jeff, you said good driving when I said that I spun from turn one to turn two.
Yeah.
The only thing I think I did right was I didn't put opposite lock in and try to catch it.
Yep.
Because if I had, I would be having shorter legs right now. So I just let it spin.
Yeah. That must be hard though, because your natural reaction of a race car driver is you don't want to give up. No, I got it. I can still recover. And I've seen drivers do that who have given up at exactly the right time. Given up meaning, I'm not going to catch this. But I think most race car drivers are like, no, I'm going to catch this. I'm not just going to give up hope here. That's got to be really hard.
It is. I mean, because it goes against our programming of if you come from road racing where you haven't had a chance to really practice that on short ovals, where the consequences are a little bit smaller, where you can get away with that. Now, did I ever dial a little bit of opposite lock in at the speedway? Yes, I have done that. But, let's say it's taking the steering wheel and
Jeff's face was just like, Right.
You probably know the numbers here, but let's say I've got 5 degrees of steering angle in to the left, and to catch the slide, I might need to bring it back to 3 degrees.
Right.
But instinct is straighten the wheel. Or even go the opposite way 2 degrees.
Right.
And that's the thing. And, the most recent thing that I can relate this to is when I was going through helicopter training. And, you're working the cyclic and you go to the helicopter when hovering, I'm going to say is the second most difficult thing I've ever done in my life is, the helicopter starts to move to the left. So you move the cyclic, you move it a little bit over. But you move it just that tiny bit too far. And now the helicopter moves the other way. And then you're like, I'll try to catch it and I'll bring it back the other way. And pretty soon you're on this pendulum swinging back and forth. And so it's learning to be very subtle with those movements. And that's where you watch a road course driver, or even, I'm going to say, I'd driven an IndyCar at Phoenix on the oval, the 1 mile oval there. And you can turn the wheel there. You've got some banking. There are tighter, shorter corners. It's a 1 mile oval, and you can turn the wheel more and you can be a little bit more aggressive with the car. But going from road course racing to the Phoenix Oval, and then that step of how much more finesse and smooth and precise and, Sam, give me the word again of turning the wheel as little as possible.
Precise-ness-ish.
Okay. Thank you.
You're welcome. I'm good.
Well, precisely subtleness. Yes, that
you,
one.
You are a Shakespeare. It's amazing.
And so, going from road course to Phoenix Oval to the Speedway, those are the kinds of jumps, and you have to build the programming to be able to handle that. And some drivers adapt to that very well. Some less so.
I think the programming's an interesting thing, right? You mentioned, you're talking about helicopters and getting behind in reactions. My dad was a flight instructor and a commercial pilot when I was younger. And the phrase the pilots use is getting behind the airplane, right? Where you get into you're chasing the thing back and forth. And everybody knows what that's like in a car. And when you get in a car, you really only get a couple of oscillations. In a helicopter, I'd imagine you can sit there and just swing back and forth all day before the thing stops being a fan blade whirly bird and falls down. But, the notion that in a car, even in a road car, you might get one or two tank slappers before the thing goes. But the idea that tuning, it's fascinating that you talk about working up through speedways and building that language, because there are some people who simply have more of that in them from what they came up doing and also just how they work. Like Mears, right? Mears Yours came up in desert racing, and that idea of knowing when you need to be really, really, really ahead of the car. You know, the guy didn't. What was it? He didn't spin at Indy. He didn't crash at Indy until 91, and I think that was because his car broke. And by that point, that year was his fourth win. Like the fact that there are people who somehow like shortcut connecting the dots, but you still have to connect them, right? It doesn't mean that you can't put it together.
And we don't make it easy on those guys as an engineer, because Ross talked about you have some steering angle, and then when you going to quote correct, you don't correct the other way. You just do a little less steering angle.
Yeah,
because one of the things, and people might appreciate this, we do many things in the car to make it turn left at Indy easily because we want it to be free. If the driver, like Ross talked about, had to actually turn the steering wheel a lot, the car would just slow down too much. It would scrub too much speed. So when a driver goes down this straightaway at Indy, he lets his hands off the wheel or reduces his grip. You don't really let it off. But if you just like relaxed your grip, the car would turn left pretty abruptly, and you would hit the inside wall. So going down the front straightaway at Indy, you're actually not turning right, but your pressure is toward the right to hold it straight. And when you get to the corner, you kind of relax that pressure. And if the engineer's done his job, the driver doesn't really have to turn the wheel much. It kind of falls into the corner. And one of the things we do, among 10 other things, but it's always blew my mind, the rear wheels, most people know what toe is. It's how the rear wheels are pointed. If toe in would be just like you do when you ski, you put the front of your skis in, and that's toe in. Or toe out would be if your skis were going out. Well, at Indy and most ovals, we don't do that. What we do is we take the right rear tire and we point it toward the wall. We toe it out. And we take the left rear tire and we toe it in, also pointing it toward the wall. So if you think about that from an extreme, rear tires are both pointed toward the wall. If you were to go straight, the rear of the car wants to hit the wall because it's pointed toward the wall. And so as the driver gets more comfortable, when he's a rookie, we don't do that. The wheels are straight. But now we're going to start freeing it up and making it go faster. So we start pointing a half a millimeter, both of those rear tires, a half a millimeter toward the wall. Then, okay, I got that. Now another half a millimeter. Now another half a millimeter. And he has to turn the steering wheel less and less each time, so he's not scrubbing as much speed, and the lap time comes. But so we're trying to make this thing, the driver, it really doesn't have much control of that. We're making this thing really twitchy, nervous, and free for him to drive, and he's got to deal with the finite amount of that. And then if he ever comes in and says, wow, that was pretty good, that was comfortable, the engineer's like, okay, we have not done a good job. This thing needs to be really uncomfortable and scaring the bejesus out of this guy for us to go fast.
It's like a variation on the old Mario quote, that something if it feels comfortable, if you're not going fast enough. No, if it feels comfortable, you just suck, right? Like it's your problem. Well, right. So yeah.
Can I talk about the visual part of this too? Is anybody that's ever driven on a road course, one of the first things you're taught is look farther ahead. Well, look farther ahead on a road course is like a tenth of how far ahead you're looking and thinking on at the speedway. Like you have to, as you're coming down the front straightaway, by the time you're at the start finish line at the speedway, and by the way, that's a long distance from there to turn one. Your mind is at the exit of turn two. Like you're coming down there and you can visualize this arc that you're going to take all the way through there. So you're seeing that in your mind. And I got to say, so Dale Coyne Racing, one of the perennial small teams, low budget, no money kind of thing, has had some success in IndyCar, but Dale grew up in Plainfield, Illinois, in the middle of cornfields. And one of the things that just really stuck with me was, he would say, when a farmer is plowing his cornfields, they don't look just in front of the tractor. They pick a point at the, as far as they can see, you know, like 12 acres away, they pick a point and they drive the tractor to it. And that's why the rows of corn are so perfectly straight.
Wait, really? I had no idea. That's how they do it?
Nowadays, they have GPS in their tractors. They push a button and the tractor drives across the field.
Oh, but right. Yeah.
Basically, that's what a farmer would do is they'd pick a point way in the distance and they'd drive to that. And then, I don't know, turn around and pick a point and drive way back to that. And that's how they could drive and draw and plant corn in straight lines. And, you know, like, okay, yeah, that makes sense. But now think about that going through turn one at the speedway, and you have to have that idea of, you know, I got to go from here to there, but it's this arc that goes around, and that arc is described by two very hard concrete walls on the outside. Well, one wall, but, you know, from that outside edge to that outside edge. And, you know, you've got to come in there, and you, on a road course, there are times where you are looking relatively close in front of your car, picking out references. At the speedway, it is, like I said, it's 10 times further ahead. And you just have to be, you have to be able to draw those arcs in your mind before you get there, like well before you get there. Because, by the way, what is it? The length of a football field in less than a second.
Yeah.
Yeah. Right.
You know, so, you know, if on a road course, you probably want to be looking, you know, you want to be looking ahead like 10 seconds ahead. Well, 10 seconds ahead at the speedway would be 12 football fields. And I'm sorry, but right. I think that's actually, you know, that's almost coming back around again. So like
it's a quarter of a lap.
Yeah. Like it's, you know, and somebody said to me, your goal is to see your own gearbox.
So, oh, right. Okay.
Kind of picture yourself looking around and you see the back of your own car. That's kind of what you need to do. And I think that's why I'm going to say, if you want to be a good road racer, go drive the Indy 500.
Race car colonoscopy. Mm-hmm. So, okay. So you mentioned the eyeballs, right? And there was a couple of years ago, there was somebody released, you and I have talked about this a lot, but somebody released footage of, I think it was Sebastian Vettel on a road course in something open wheel, and they had eyeball trackers on him. And you could see that.
Nico Hülkenberg.
It was Hülkenberg. That's right. Yes. You could see that at any given point, he wasn't just looking ahead. It was some ungodly number of movements where it was, you know, the vanishing point, then the apex, then the front wheels, then the wheel, then the dash, then the vanishing point again, then like 30 points in between the nose of the car and the exit of the corner. And all of that was constant. Do you have to reprogram how you use your eyes on a speedway and slow them down? Because like the first time you and I talked about that, I went and ran a club race somewhere, tested something for one of the magazines and got in the car and then actively thought about how much I was moving my eyes. And I'm no Hülkenberg, but it was the same basic idea where you don't realize just how much you're taking in when you're trying to keep your eyes up and pay attention. But in speedway work, do you end up, is that a different piece of software or is it the same thing? Have you read any studies or seen anything that anybody's done with that eyeball wise?
So I've not seen eye tracking on a driver at the speedway.
Yeah.
I believe it's the same process. It's just, you're kind of spreading things out even more just because the track is so much bigger.
Right.
So, and I got to think that, you know, when Scott Dixon is driving the speedway, his eyes are moving in that same kind of way. They're flowing, they're scanning, they're moving. And, you know, because it's one thing, you know, well, all we've done mostly at this point and talked about driving one car around the speedway. Well, then you're out there with 32 other cars and you're thinking about drafting. And, you know, I think the one other thing that Rick Mears talked to me about is he could imagine the airflow off of other cars around him, and he used that. And I think, Jeff, I think you've talked about this before in terms of like NASCAR. Like I think Dale Earnhardt used to talk about how he could see the airflow coming off the sides of the other car and how he used that for a side draft. And I think, so, you know, one of the things that I talk about in Coach Drivers On is this process that we use with our vision. And the number one part of it is what I call mental vision. And that is seeing things that you physically can't see. Some of them you have to kind of imagine doing it. And it's like, you know, it's like sitting in a chair at home, closing your eyes and imagining driving your favorite racetrack. Okay, now do that at speed as you're approaching a corner at 220 miles an hour. Can you see the exit of turn two when you're turning into turn one? Yes, I can. You know, I got to the point where I was like, yes, I can do that. Could I do that with 32 other cars around me and also picture about how the air is flowing off the car and all that kind of stuff? I couldn't do that right now. Now, right. I would like to think that given the experience of a Rick Mears or a Scott Dixon, I could learn to do that. But I'm also going to say that there seems to be some people have a better ability to imagine what they can't see. And in a dynamic way, not in a static way, but in a way that's happening right now at, like I said, football field in a second or less than a second.
It's crazy. I think that's probably a pretty good note to end it on, right? I mean, the notion that all of this, we've spent this entire episode talking about what it is to simply go around the place by yourself. And it isn't that. It's a 220 mile an hour chess match that goes on for 500 miles an hour. Like, that's just kind of hard to wrap your head around in a lot of ways. Just makes it, it's one of those things. One of the reasons I love it is, you know, the more you learn about it, the deeper you get, the bigger it gets and the more interesting it gets. But
yep. I tell people, don't let anybody, I have engineers who are like, I get to go to the Indy 500 and run my first race at the Indy 500. What's your advice? I said, don't let anybody tell you it's just another race. It's just another racetrack. This is special. Soak all of that in. And as a rookie driver, man, that's like to the nth degree that it is not just another race for a rookie driver. No way.
Well, thanks, Russ. I learned an awful lot. And that leaves us at the end of our show. We're out of time. That's our episode. Tune in next week when our topic, what did I have on the sheet? It was Ross and Jeff will be talking about the time that Ross picked Jeff up from a jail in suburban Illinois. And they had this plan. They were going to go out and put the old band back together to save an orphanage or something. But then things got complicated and Princess Leia blew up a building and they had to run from some Nazis. But again, you know, Ross drove the Bluesmobile just real good and it even flew through the air and they both just went to jail. And it was great, though. The car fell apart and everybody was happy. Something, something Elvis song. We will
the end.
Except they made sequels and they weren't good. Okay, we will see you next time. Thanks for listening.
Have fun.